Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Woozencroft, and it's a perplexing day, to say the least, for most football fans. England did their usual pre-tournament thing and beat the best team in the world. Scotland are undefeated in over a year. Liverpool and Manchester United look to hijack football as we know it. And we're about to be charged £14.95 to watch and experience it all in the middle of a pandemic-induced recession. Questions to be answered, to say the least. Just another day in the life of Gregor Robertson and Tom Clark, who joined me this morning. Hello, guys.
Hello, Hugh. Hi, Tom. I'm trying to be very excited and enthusiastic this morning after you slagged off my welcome the other day on the show, said I sounded too tired. So, hi, how's it going? Morning.
Good.
Morning.
You should come to this with some verve, you know, that the world gets to hear you talk about football. You're in a privileged position and you get to see me. I mean, what more do you want, frankly, on a Monday morning?
It's a great start to the week.
Exactly. Listen, I'm always smiling, so I just expect other people should be like me. I'm sorry. What can I say? Look, there's plenty for us to talk about. We're going to check in with the Times' Molly Hudson a little bit later on as well, talking about the Women's Super League. But we're going to start by catching up with our chief football writer, Henry Winter. I asked him about a story you're going to see across the back pages, Project Big Picture, big reform plans coming from the top teams in the Premier League. It affects the football pyramid in England as a whole as well. We'll get the details on that shortly. But I started by asking Henry about Sunday evening at Wembley, England managing to beat the world's number one side, Belgium, 2-1 in Nations League action. As England seem to always do on the build-up to a big tournament, we've beaten the best side in the world to obviously get hopes as high as possible before their inevitable group stage exit. But what did you make of Sunday evening at Wembley, England beating the world's number one side in the shape of Belgium in the Nations League?
I think the good thing about Gareth Southgate now, and particularly with his players, is that they don't get carried away. No one was coming out and saying afterwards that we've beaten the world's number one, Belgium, the team of De Bruyne and Lukaku, we're going to storm through the Euros, we'll be back here for the final at Wembley next summer. I think there's a bit of humility, born quite rightly through years of painful experience. I think it's the message that Southgate wants to send out. It's always the All Black thing. It's all about the team and humility and not getting carried away. I also think if you look particularly at the first half, there was no reason to get carried away. I thought England were poor. They weren't compact enough. They look, almost in a way, looked like a McLaren team with players slightly in the wrong position. But I think what's good under Southgate, and we saw this at the World Cup, even when they weren't playing particularly well, and we saw it in their run to the Nations League last time, is that there's a resilience to them. There's a character to them. There's a good mix of the experienced players and the youthful younger ones. And they look after each other. They are very much a family. So whereas in the past, we've seen maybe club cliques, there isn't that. You know, you see someone like Declan Rice, West Ham, and Mason Mount, Chelsea. Obviously, they started out their careers together, but there's such a strong bond between them. So I think, yeah, they showed their character, but I think there's a lot of work to be done before they're going to get to a final.
Very much so. I'd have to agree with you on that, particularly as you said, the first half. This dilemma that Gareth Southgate seems to be pondering around the defence and around whether it should be a back five or a back four, and the last few games it has been a back five, but it wasn't functioning. Belgium could play through that back five quite easily in the first half. They were getting players just running at the defence and you know, especially Carrasco having lots of success. Does he have a big issue with his defence?
I mean, you're right. Carrasco was absolutely outstanding. I thought he was probably the best player on the park with De Bruyne for spells and Kyle Walker, certainly defensively for England. I think it's interesting when you talk to Southgate at the moment, he is so wedded to 3-4-3. Obviously, England played a sort of 3-5-1-1 effectively with Sterling behind Kane at the World Cup. And it's interesting when he talks about it, because we said to him, 4-3-3 was so effective in Seville. You absolutely took out, particularly in the first half, a fantastic Spanish team. You know, they'd never been beaten in their backyard for years. And England and Rashford and Kane and Sterling absolutely tore them apart with their movement and their finishing. Why don't you continue with 4-3-3? And he said, well, that's okay against certain teams, but I have to hide the weaknesses. And that's a pretty poignant expression that Southgate uses, to hide the weaknesses. And to hide the weaknesses, clearly, is he can't completely trust his defence. Maguire is a good leader, but he can get done for pace. Dyer, I still don't know what Eric Dyer's best position, whether he's a holding midfield or centre-half. And last night, Kyle Walker, as I say, was excellent. He's still a right-back. He was playing as a right-sided centre-half. There's obviously Joe Gomez to come back in there. You know, England do have options at the back. But I don't think Southgate completely trusts him. So that's why he wants a three. Plus, also, you look at, you know, playing against one of the best teams, well, the best team in the world in terms of ranking. He then goes and plays two essentially holding defensive midfielders in Declan Rice and Jordan Henderson. So, you know, you look at that. It was interesting talking to one of the players last night. He described it as a back five. He wasn't having any of this wing-back stuff. He was saying that was a back five. And then two in front of him. You've effectively got a block of seven there, or five plus two. So I think that's Southgate's caution. And I think even though he's got some maverick talents on the bench, Jack Grealish particularly, I think he'll be cautious, and he'll want to 1-0 all his way to the final next year.
That's interesting, because I know a lot of England fans, and I'm probably one of them, would be screaming out for Jack Grealish to start every single game. Even Phil Foden, if he comes back into the reckoning, I think would be a starter for me, because I think there's a lack of creativity. And you talk about a back seven and being able to hide the weaknesses, but we didn't hide any of the weaknesses. It was quite apparent where the weaknesses were, even with the seven. So why not try and take the game to other teams, and why not have an element of creativity in there in particular? You know, people talk about Mason Mount, for example, and I know he got a deflected winner last night, but Southgate seems to constantly back him, tries to turn the conversation away from the likes of Jack Grealish. Well, why do you think that is?
Out of possession. I think Mason Mount does give you more. He will track back. He will cover. Jack Grealish is a wonderful maverick talent. He gives you something extra. I mean, the comparisons with Gazza are annoying for Grealish, Southgate, and everyone associated with England. But what he does give you, and there are echoes, is that unpredictability, taking people on. And, you know, Southgate was obviously at Euro 96, painfully at the end, but he will have seen that actually for a team to go far, they are going to need a little bit of a game breaker, someone who just makes things happen, and Grealish can do that. But at the moment, I think you're looking at a flat back five, you're looking at two holding midfielders, and then you're looking at a front line of Sterling, Kane and Rashford. Now, the problem that Grealish has got is that if his best position, as we've seen at Aston Villa, is not as a 10. It's coming in from the left. And Rashford's not going to give up that place easily, and rightly so.
Interesting. I don't know if that should really be Marcus Rashford's decision. You know, you've got Sterling there as well.
You're not going to drop Marcus Rashford. You are not going to drop Marcus Rashford. I think that England front line is as good an attack as pretty much anyone in the top three in the world.
So, listen, we're talking about two players that didn't play last night, if we're talking about Grealish and Sterling. But if Sterling's best position is on the left, where does Marcus Rashford go? On the right? And where does Jadon Sancho go? And look, this is a great dilemma for England to have. But would you, you know, it's difficult for me, given his club form, to think that if everyone is back and fit and healthy and ready to go, that Rashford is in England starting 11. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think you probably are from Southgate's perspective, with great respect. I think his front three will absolutely be Rashford on the left, Sterling on the right. Look, Sterling's so versatile. We've seen him play as a false nine, we've seen him play as a 10, we've seen him play as a centre forward. I mean, he can play anywhere across that front three. And obviously Harry Kane, the captain in the middle, that's sort of non-negotiable. So those three, that is actually the one settled area of the England team that you know that. Jadon Sancho is a fantastic option to come off the bench. Grealish and Foden obviously give you something different as well. Teams develop during tournaments, and it might be that Rashford starts the Euros and Grealish finishes it. But at the moment, I think the way... And you can't divorce in Southgate's mind what Rashford's doing off the pitch with what he's doing on the pitch as well. That Southgate's so big on that. He keeps on talking about good citizens. And Rashford is absolutely the embodiment of that. And I was slightly surprised in one of the games that he wasn't captain because of the, not simply because of the MBE, but I think because of the message that he sends out. And if you look at Rashford and if you look at him and how he delivers in pressure moments, PSG for Manchester United, and obviously the penalty yesterday. He's a pretty impressive individual as a footballer as well as a person. Look, I will definitely fight Marcus Rashford's corner on his starting qualities.
Let's talk Project Big Picture then, move away from England. I'll be outlining the details in a few moments' time. You've been speaking about this already, the radical reform proposals that would see the top flight cut to 18 teams, the League Cup go, the Community Shield go, as well as among a raft of other changes. What did you make of all of it?
I feel it was embarrassing. I'm surprised Rick Parry isn't being pushed close to resignation. I think there'll be civil war within the Premier League. If you are Leeds United and you've fought your way up, if you are Aston Villa and you've invested judiciously and you've just put seven past Liverpool, who are one of the big masterminds, as it were, Bond style of this daft project, Operation Avarice, as we're calling it, then I think you're just saying, what on earth are they doing? What on earth? I mean, English football cannot be run by Joel Glazer. I don't really want Joel Glazer running Manchester United. I just think that he's all about the money. So he's going to give money up front to the EFL, him and John Henry at Liverpool. You know what? It's not actually all their own money. That money is broadcast money that should go to Aston Villa, that should go to Burnley, that should go to Wolves. All those teams that he really doesn't want to join the VIP club at the top. This is purely about self-interest. It's actually more than a power grab. It's just so damn... Everyone said, well, people are saying, well, listen, it's going to help the pyramid. Effectively what they're doing is giving the same amount of money that they're going to give to agents this year to the EFL in return for going down to 18 clubs in the Premier League, and also for effectively denuding the Football Association of any authority because the clubs will run it now, and English football will be run from Boston and the Everglades.
Sounds remarkable and sad in many ways, but some people already alluding to the fact that this might bring about the fight for the European Super League, the thing that we've always seen coming. Do you think coronavirus and the financial impact of 2020 will accelerate those arguments?
Definitely. I think you are seeing that those clubs, Liverpool and Manchester United in particular, and fair play to their supporters, by the way, for coming out and saying we should not be doing this. You know, there's some very conscientious supporters at those clubs who are aghast with what their owners are doing. I think absolutely we'll see it as a step on the road to a European Super League. And I just find it very sad that this is, and ironic in a way, that this has cropped up after we've had this celebration of the vibrancy of the 20-club Premier League. When you did get Aston Villa's result, when you did get Tottenham's 6-1 result, you know, that's what the Premier League is about. No one really was going to predict that Tottenham would get that result before. You do get that on any day, an underdog can do something, as well as having this, you know, the excellence of the top teams. I just think that I don't really see the logic of meddling with the Premier League at the moment. I think the owners and those two clubs in particular, Liverpool and Manchester United, are in a way very fortunate that games are behind closed doors, because their fans, their conscientious fans in the Kop, in the Stretford End, would turn on their owners and say, not in our name. We don't want to effectively ruin the Premier League and the vibrancy of the Premier League just so that the owners have more power. So look, I just think it's embarrassing. It is greed laid bare.
Henry Winter, chief football writer of the Times there. And you can read Henry's views in today's Times or on our app. Operation Avarice, as he's calling it. He's got some fantastic views on that. Great read. Gregor, Tom, let's start with this then. Project Big Picture. There are some good points and some very bad points proposed. Let me just give everyone the lowdown on it before I get your views. Personally, I think it is a power grab by England's biggest clubs. I'll agree with Henry on that. But some of the main points: an immediate rescue fund of £250 million for the English Football League, £100 million for the Football Association. There would be a £20 cap on away tickets in the Premier League, subsidised Premier League away travel. The League Cup and the Community Shield would both be abolished. Parachute payments would be scrapped. The Premier League would be 18 teams instead of 20. At the end of the season, there would be a playoff between the 16th team in the Premier League and the Championship team that has won their playoff. Nine clubs, as Henry mentioned, would be given special voting rights on certain issues. That is the traditional top six in the Premier League: Everton, West Ham, and Southampton. There are a raft of other infrastructure deals in there for football league clubs as well, and various support. Lots of details within this, but essentially the Premier League is firmly against it, and the EFL chairman Rick Parry has already come out and publicly supported it. The question that runs through my mind is, we've already discussed it so many times on the podcast, what could eventually ruin football as a whole? I think we're getting closer to it.
Yeah, before we kind of bore down into detail, the thing that I found when I read this, first of all, on Sunday, was, aside from my blood boiling a little bit, is just the kind of the sheer audacity that owners of a select group of clubs at this moment in history feel empowered enough to try and take ownership of English football and its direction for forevermore. I mean, can you get your head around that? I found it staggering, and I think the point that Henry made about Rick Parry needs to be brought to the fore pretty quickly, because Rick Parry was involved in setting up the Premier League nearly 30 years ago, which he stands by and says was, you know, one of the best decisions that's ever happened in football. And this is what brought us to this point: the great inequality and the sort of the creaking, you know, the pyramids kind of crumbling at from the bottom up. And now, you know, that put all the power of football in England in the hands of 20 clubs, and now he's trying to reduce that to 6 clubs. And he's done it. I've written about the Football League for many years, and the number of times when the EFL have been accused of inaction when owners have been driving football clubs into the ground, or ineptitude when, you know, they fail to uphold their rules. The fact, you know, they always hid behind the fact that they were just a competition organiser. And now its chairman is trying to fundamentally alter the structure of English football without consulting any members. Or he's maybe consulted a few members. And the other thing is, it's what's so insidious about it is that I actually think that a lot of football league clubs would probably support it because they're that desperate for the money. So we're in it. What they've done, it's kind of clever about it, is that they're paying off vast swathes of English football who, you know, at a time of, even before a pandemic struck, were kind of on the edge. And that's a payoff in order to take control of the direction of English football and sort of entrench their status as the big six in English football. I think it's disgusting.
I mean, I find myself increasingly over the last few weeks getting more and more annoyed about the various stories that come out relating to the survival of English football and the pyramid and ways to solve it. But I'm going to try and stay fairly measured if I can. Now, I think the scariest thing is the point Gregor alluded to at the end there. For me, I think there are a lot of clubs, and my understanding would be that there are a fair amount of clubs who would actually go for this on the basis that initial wedge of cash would be seen as such a lifesaver. And Henry obviously talked about the Glazers at Manchester United and money, and you have to think broadly about why you own a football club. And there are far too many owners within the Football League who aren't invested in their club in any proper way, be it financially or emotionally. You know, there are so many, my understanding is that there are a lot of owners out there in the Football League who, if they were given even a half decent offer to sell their club, they would take it. And so this deal with its initial financial lump would be seen as such a enticing offer that further down the line, 5-10 years time, would be absolutely crippling for clubs in the Football League, because I don't see how when you actually unpick the details of it, I don't see what the benefits are, other than that initial lump of cash which would bail them out.
Well, they get quite a, you know, the solidarity payments from the Premier League rise from 4% to 25% in the plan, but there's clear incentive for these clubs to do that, to be in favour of it, because they, you know, if Lincoln, say, look at the Premier League, which is so distant in the first instance, but even then, you know, first of all, getting into the Premier League is miles off, but then breaking into the top six is like, you know, on a different planet. So why do they care about what, you know, the sort of internal struggles and battles within the Premier League if they're getting a rise of, what is that, 19% in their annual funding from the Premier League? That's what's so insidious about it. So the most of the Football League clubs are looking at this going, we don't really care about the Premier League are thinking, you know, are kind of arguing and squabbling over about the direction of football, because right now we're getting money, 250 million to save us, to help us survive the season, and then on top of that we're getting increased funding. And let's, you know, we could go through this bit by bit and say that's a positive. That 25%, a rise of that magnitude in solidarity payments, you know, it begins to eat away at the huge gulf between the Premier League and the rest, and the pressures that creates. But it's all built upon a power grab, and once the power grab's happened, there's no going back. And then who's to say that wouldn't be eaten away at again? And you know, 10 years down the line, they look at it and say, why are we giving these clubs outside the Premier League 25%?
Exactly, and there are other aspects to it where, if you're talking about clubs at League One, League Two level and how they make their money, you know, talk about scrapping the League Cup. The only people, as we've discussed on the podcast before, for whom scrapping the League Cup would be a benefit are the big six teams, really. There is merits to the League Cup in terms of making money for clubs in the Football League. Even if you take out the big six, an opportunity to play against West Ham, Leicester, these are big name Premier League clubs within the League Cup. If there's an incentive at the end of it for financial gain, to win a trophy. There is already a cup competition existing in this country in the form of the leasings.com trophy, the Vanarama, etc., the Checker Trade, whatever you want to call it, that Football League clubs and the fans are already vehemently opposed to on a large scale basis, because it's seen the introduction of B teams from the Premier League already. And that would be the competition that I think a lot of Football League teams would like to scrap in favour of probably a better League Cup. But then if you think about it from that point of view, if you scrap the League Cup, FA Cup games, the FA Cup maybe gets more competitive because teams like Leicester, West Ham, that ilk want to compete for a cup, so it becomes more difficult for Championship, League One, League Two clubs to pull off shocks. Another scary aspect of it for me was the suggestion of the changing of the loan system, where Premier League clubs can farm out loan players. And obviously, as we've said before, there are ways for Football League clubs to make money is by building their own players and growing their own players and selling them on up the pyramid. If you're going to end up with four players from Man United or Liverpool at your club, and clubs like of that ilk can send out up to 15 players on loan to domestically, you're going to end up with, you know, teams in League One playing against each other, and it's essentially the lads in the youth academy going up against each other, you know, 3-on-3.
I'd actually say that they've been measured in their starting point with that too, because if you were to look at the number of loans that one Premier League club sent out to the Football League last season, none sent more than 15, and the rule is already 4. But this is it fundamentally comes down to the fact that the power It's gone forever.
Yeah, it's
that will
a start,
be their decision in future.
It's so, a start. Yeah. So suddenly you get 6 and 8 and 10, and then after that, it's, you know, they're feeder clubs, aren't they? Straight away.
Personally, there's a lot of things I could, you know, I tried to take a bit of a dispassionate moment and say, I could probably cope with the reduction to 18 teams in the Premier League. I could probably cope with the end of the Carabao Cup. No matter what their sort of their reasons for that is, in terms of, you know, a bigger, you know, people to go on tour in pre-season and make more money or play more European fixtures, whatever. The fact is that the voting rights is the key aspect in this. Once you've handed over the voting rights to six clubs, it's not nine clubs because it only needs to be two-thirds, and the voting rights for those things that even has, there's a line at the bottom of it, which I said here, they can alter in a material way the nature of the competition. That says it all. The running governance of football in this country is in the hands of six clubs, and who knows where that goes.
Rick Parry's just been on TalkSport. He says Project Big Picture solves every single inequality facing the EFL.
It does a lot. As I said, going from four to...
But doesn't it basically draw up the ladder? You know, it creates two footballs in England, and it almost negates your ability to reach the top level of football and sustain yourself there if you're an EFL club.
As I said, that's already there. That's what a lot of EFL clubs look at this and think that's already the case. You know, we don't care about that. So the redistribution of wealth has been the biggest issue in the kind of sustainability of lower league and EFL football for decades now. So this goes a long way to it. And that, you know, if you took those aspects in isolation, and you looked at the solidarity payments rising from 4% to 25%, you know, I think it says a 66% increase in contributions to good causes in England. Clubs get £100 a seat to spend on infrastructure, subsidised away travel, all these things. Yeah, they're good. These are good things, but it's the cost. You can't look at that in isolation, and there's no way that they're going to grant this without the power grab. So it needs to be burned.
I think there's an element as well to the pulling up the drawbridge argument, where, as Greg has said, that has already happened a long time ago in some respects. You know, as a Lincoln fan now, even the prospect of reaching the Championship is slightly terrifying, because all that happens is you reach that level, as Wickham have seen this season, and found it incredibly difficult. And as Gregor says, it's the redistribution of wealth that is the issue. I don't really have any, you know, aspirations for Lincoln to reach the Premier League. It'd be a good laugh for a season, but I don't think there'd be that much enjoyment to be gained from it. You know, my uncle's a Huddersfield fan, has been for many, many years, has been a season ticket holder. He says the least enjoyable season he's had as a season ticket holder was the time in the Premier League. Because, there's delusions around what that means and reaching the promised land and da-da-da-da-da. And essentially, it's for that big wedge of cash that you get. But in terms of the enjoyment of football, I don't have any aspirations to reach the Premier League. You know, a friend of mine is also a West Brom fan. He says he finds it really difficult when they get promoted to the Premier League, because he's happy on one sense that, you know, bigger projection, more money. Is he going to enjoy watching the games as much? Probably not. So this idea of pulling up the drawbridge, I don't think he's quite right, in a sense, because the aim, I think, for a lot of clubs isn't to necessarily reach the Premier League anyway. So as Gregor says, it's not necessarily about, oh, they're bothered about the Premier League, because they're not aspiring to get there in the first place.
We've put quite a slant on the thoughts and the feelings of the EFL clubs here. We should actually look at the 14 clubs who aren't part of the big six, because the drawbridge has been pulled up on them as well. At the moment, the ratio, you know, depending upon how successful you are in the Premier League, is 1.8 of revenue streams to one. You know, so the bottom Premier League club, the top Premier club gets 1.8 compared to one, and that could rise to 4 to 1. And also the fact that they would adhere to align with the UEFA financial fair play regulations, which are far more stringent than ours, means that all those clubs that aren't in the big six, who aren't getting the same sizable revenues, they can't even spend more to invest to try and bridge the gap. So it just further, you know, takes the big six further and further away. So there's several ladders being drawn up here, but the biggest one is just that the power is gone forever.
I am a Manchester United fan, but I'm from London. I'm from northwest London. I grew up in Wembley, a 5-minute walk from Wembley FC, We near the likes of Hendon, Harrow, and Wealdstone. The lower league football structure, in fact, the non-league structure, Isthmian League at the time as it was like a massive part of my football upbringing, because the people that you knew, the people that you went and played football with at the local leisure centre would sign for Luton. And, you know, if they were lucky, they'd sign for QPR. You know, no one was going to sign for Manchester United or Arsenal or, you know, Chelsea even for that matter. You know, the players from Brent, where I'm from, you know, Queen's Park Rangers or Watford was like, wow. And, you know, like I grew up with Jamaican parents and the story of John Barnes being at Wembley, you know, players that have been at Hayes and Yedding, you know, like that is the sort of environment that I was raised in terms of football playing and the people that I played football with. And obviously I'm a Manchester United fan, but like when I look at plans like this, it's like when we talk about Facebook or Amazon paying tax. An argument for, well, I should only pay 3 million quid of tax a year, even though I made 3 billion, because, you know, of all the companies that we work with and all the money that we provide to an industry and whatnot, it doesn't make any sense. You know, it's just someone who will never be able to spend all the money they earn claiming they need more money. I follow American sport a lot and I love American sport, and they couldn't care less about sharing it around. They could not care less. You have teams based in Oakland for 50 years and then go and then say they're going to go to Las Vegas and then back and forth, or San Diego and Detroit, or, you know, they don't care. They'll take the name, they'll move the team, you know, they will essentially go where they believe they'll make the most money at any given time. They don't care. And what I find the hardest bit of all of this is people don't realize that American sport, and I think Henry and Glazer want this model in the UK, when they talk about materially changing the competition, it isn't just about who can be in it. It's not just about the money. It's about controlling other people in it. So, for example, if a player in the United States is arrested for something unsavory, you know, it's not like they get the chance to continue their careers until they go through their court case and are found either innocent or guilty. You know, the league just says they don't really fit with our brand, so you can't sign them. And their careers just stop there. And, you know, the likes of Jack Grealish breaking lockdown rules, they might have said, you can't play for the next season.
I think the first thing to say is that this has apparently been under discussion for 3 years. So Rick Parry was discussing this, and apparently, you know, only reported, he pitched this to the EFL when he got the EFL chairman's job a year ago. So although it might seem like this is really opportunistic, the plan was to reveal this towards the end of last season, until the pandemic struck. Obviously now it does look very, very much opportunistic. But I think this has been an overarching plan for, you know, under consideration for a number of years. And I think that there might be an aspect now, as you say, that the opportunism is that the government... I went to Cambridge at the weekend, Cambridge United, League Two club, going well. I spoke to their CEO, and one of the first things he said turned out to be kind of prophetic. He said, it's becoming increasingly obvious that the Premier League, if the Premier League are going to help, they're going to want to extract a price. And 24 hours later, what did we see here? He was talking about things like B teams or support for foreign players flooding into academies post-Brexit. But what he believes now, he said to me afterwards, is that, you know, the government were expecting the Premier League to bail the rest of football out, and the Premier League were looking at the government and saying, what are we going to get in return? And this is a line in the sand. This is the battleground we're talking about now. It's not going to be about getting fans back in, because that's not going to make them any money. There's a bigger plan in action here now. It's about taking control of a direction of football, and I just think it's hugely dangerous.
Firstly, I'm delighted, Hugh, that when you take the Game podcast to new award-winning, money-spinning heights, that you're going to remember the boys and where you came from, and you know, make sure we're up there with you in the
we get a share.
Great success, and we get a share. That's great to hear. But I mean,
you're not getting a share now.
No, absolutely not. I wish. But I think the thing we keep coming back to is Rick Parry's role in pushing this on behalf of the EFL. And something we've talked about a lot is whether there's a way of getting more fan involvement in the running of the Football League. Because what you have far too often is owners who don't have any real interest in the clubs, and the people who suffer, Macclesfield, Bury in recent times, are ultimately the fans. You know, they lose their club, they lose their identity, they lose a massive part of their local community. And you only need to look at the Football League across the country now to see that it's reliant on owners who have, who being good owners, being good people essentially, and having some kind of personal investment in the community, in the area, and ultimately just caring about the club in itself. If you don't have that, then you're in big trouble as a Football League club, because you're beholden to an owner who might drop you at any minute. And in these difficult times, it's becoming increasingly tempting to just write it all off and go, do you know what, I cannot be bothered with this, because there's no benefit to owning this club. There's no way of making any money. Why am I doing this? And so that's the scary thing to me. You have all these fans across the country, heavily invested, whose lives would be changed forever if they lost their club without any say whatsoever. And that's, if we're going to really talk about reframing football, that's something that I think should be happening through the Football League, is working out how to get greater fan involvement in terms of discussing the future of the club and having their say.
Eight of the nine clubs that would be the, you know, have the power, although only six of them would have, are from overseas, be it America, China, you know. And the ninth is West Ham's owners. So it's not the fact that they're foreign owners that makes them their motives questionable, but as you say, perhaps the connection to that history is not shared. And essentially, in Man United and Liverpool's case, they're American venture capitalists, so they want to get as big a return as they possibly can.
The desire to shoehorn Manchester City into those nine means that somehow Southampton get the keys to the kingdom as well. It's just perverse. You know, like a team that was in League One, what, you know, six or seven years ago, is it? You know, maybe a bit longer. Come on.
I mean, the other thing to say is that, you know, thankfully, it seems that it isn't just us three who are against these proposals. There does seem to be already quite a significant backlash in terms of...
But do they own football clubs?
So should we not kind of briefly consider what comes next then?
No, because... absolutely. All I'm saying is that I think this is an interesting moment now, in that there is such a powerful backlash of this is a disgrace against these proposals, but you would hope that there isn't just a complete dismissal of the idea of reformatting and restructuring the football pyramid because of this idea being, you know, ultimately having the serious negative of being a power grab, as we've said. But I do fear that when you have the government and the Premier League and, you know, big commentators saying this is a disgrace, you end up with nothing, whereas something needs to be done, doesn't it?
I don't know. I mean, two things. One is that there have been reports that Rick Parry has said if there's a touch of pushback to this, then you can resign. You could resign. Those big six could resign from the Premier League and join the Football League. You know, and that was put to him, and he said no comment. He decided to make no comment about that on Sunday. So that's one thing to say. And the other is, I saw somebody say, "Why? What's to stop the other 14 clubs packaging all the good bits of this and saying we'll vote this through, but we don't want any of the power?" You know, we can do that. We can do as much of the good stuff here, but we're not going to take power. And I think the answer to that is probably that would be the start of the end of the Premier League. It would mean that the clubs would want to break away. So there has to be, the big six would want to break away from a European Super League. This, you know, some people think this is a bigger end of it anyway. So there has to be some kind of balance struck in this. And it's about having as much of the good stuff and diluting as much of the power that they're trying to grab.
Gregor, there was a part of me last night, and I asked Henry Winter about it earlier, about that European Super League, and I understand as a Manchester United fan that we would be in it. I can't really describe this without swearing. I'm not going to. But my views on that are, if they want to leave, they can do one. And that is because I believe in the English football pyramid. No, listen, I know you're rolling your eyes, Gregor, but let me explain it then. Let me explain it to you then. Eventually, there will be a European Super League. Eventually, there will be a league played Wednesday nights, and there will be teams that want to be in the Premier League at the weekend and play in their European League midweeks and make as much money as they can from TV revenue.
Why are you resigned to that fact?
Because money eventually will dictate everything.
Well, then we may as well just pass this through now, because that's, you know, it's going to happen. They're going to have the power to make decisions anyway.
But listen, I'm not saying that they're going to have I'm not going to give them power over the clubs that they leave behind. That's my point. If you want to leave, leave. You don't want to be part of English football, the Premier League anymore, go. If you think your economic power base is so great that you don't need the league that you came up in, fine, go. If Celtic or Rangers wanted to leave Scotland, they can leave. And if they want to play in the Premier League, if that makes them more money, or the Chinese League, if that makes them more money, then fine. In my personal view is, that's fine, as long as they don't control the other teams in there. Because ultimately, they can do, and they will legally be able to do what they want in the future. My point is, as a fan of Manchester United, if you don't support the English football pyramid, you don't deserve to be in it. I couldn't care how many trophies you've won. If you think that you're wedded to European football more than English football, you can leave, in my opinion. If you think that the money that you bring in and the money that you make is and the survival of your club, in fact, not even the survival, your club flourishing while others go bust is the way that you want football to be, then go and play in a European football Super League and let West Ham United or whoever gets left behind win the Premier League title every year. You know, I would rather watch that.
I think that I agree with the sentiment in terms of the ferocity with which you're kind of, you know, passionately saying, you know, do one, because I certainly feel the same at times. I think that there is an element of where, and Henry again alluded to this earlier, where the fans of these big clubs will have a big part to play in this, because perhaps I'm being a little bit too naive here, but when you think back to the Manchester City owners and the people who bought Manchester City and been involved in them, they talked a lot about the reason they decided to buy Manchester City was the huge following they had within Manchester, even when Manchester City dropped down the football pyramid, and that being a massive lure initially. I do think that would have a part to play. I know you've said about, you know, the future of football being just beamed around the world without fans. Part of the sell of football is the fanatical supporter being in the ground, in the stadium, and obviously we've talked, that's a separate conversation in the current climate, but if you went down that road that you've talked about there, Manchester United, Liverpool, Manchester City would lose a lot of their local support, and without that, you're not the Manchester City and the Manchester United and the Liverpool that supporters in China and elsewhere across the world are buying into. You're not the same club, and therefore you have a knock-on effect of that your image is damaged. And if your image is damaged, I mean, God knows we live in a world where image is everything in all walks of life. If your image and how you are presented to the world is damaged, you become less attractive as something to invest in, something for people across the world to invest in. And so I think even the Glazers would react and would think twice before really, really shafting the fans who live in Salford and in Manchester. You know, there is enough already to show that idea wouldn't get past a lot of these fans. And I do, again, maybe you tell me I'm being naive, but that is why there are so many global supporters of Manchester United and Liverpool, because they've been hugely successful over the last 20, 30 years. But also because you look at the club from an outside and you go, wow, look at all those fans. Look at those fans on the cop singing You'll Never Walk Alone. You know, look at the millions of people streaming into Old Trafford, the nights at Old Trafford in the Champions League under the Fergie era, Stretford End, etc., etc. Like, that's been the sell. That's why these clubs are global icons. And that idea of go on, off you go and make your Super League where you're just beamed around the world without anyone, you're seriously underselling what you could have as a product without that image and those fans, I think. And I think the backlash would be such that it would stop that from happening. I hope.
You'd hope so. Otherwise, look, I would say you're being naive and I'd be a cynic.
But it's fine. We can all become Lincoln fans then, and the world will be a much, much better place for it. It'll be fine.
Listen, Salford City would probably be delighted, you know, the amount of fans that might go and watch them. if this were to happen. And we could talk about it for about 3 hours, to be perfectly honest. We are going to move on, but we could probably turn it into a special after that conversation. By the way, to enjoy more of our award-winning sports journalism, including all of our writing on this topic, then just subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times today to get 1 month free. Just go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Let's pause for a moment and check in on the Women's Super League. There's been plenty of action so far this season that we haven't discussed, but I think this is a good opportunity to do so. Of course, continues during the international break for the men. So far this year, we have already seen a raft of global superstars come to the Women's Super League. 4 games in, let's see how the best players are performing. Earlier on, I spoke to a sports journalist from The Times, Molly Hudson, who's been focusing in on this, and asked her about the great start to the season that Chelsea have had. Molly, let's start with the weekend. Chelsea keeping up their great run and Arsenal with a big win as well.
Definitely. I think, obviously, the game of the weekend was Chelsea-Manchester City yesterday, and I was lucky enough to be there and to see that, and just to spend an awful long time kind of squinting over replays, as seems to be the kind of pattern recently in men's and women's football. Disappointingly, kind of the biggest and I guess first kind of incident of note in the game was the handball award for the first goal, which was disappointing because we know that games, particularly in the Women's Super League with Chelsea, Manchester City and Arsenal so dominant, games between those three clubs tend to be really close and tend to be such small margins, and it did feel a little bit like that yesterday. Yes, Chelsea were the better team overall and deserved to win, but certainly getting the lead was a kind of big slice of luck from a penalty that shouldn't have been a penalty because it was never a handball, and certainly not for Ellen White, who was actually booked.
Arsenal, big win for them over Brighton as well. Will Chelsea be looking over their shoulder slightly at these?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because Arsenal have done so well in recent years when it comes to playing the teams outside of that big three. I think they're definitely the team that has really got into the routine and got into the consistency, whereas, you know, both Chelsea and Manchester City have probably had recent records better in the clashes against Arsenal, but have already both dropped points. So I think Arsenal are doing really well in terms of racking up the points, racking up the goals against the smaller teams. I mean, it's hard to look any further than Vivian Miedema. This weekend, she equaled the all-time Women's Super League goal-scoring record with 49 goals. And I think she's done that in 49 appearances, which is just remarkable.
Absolutely incredible. At 23 goals for them already, conceded just 3. Top of the table, Arsenal. Everton second as well. Should mention them, 4 wins out of 4.
Hugely impressive so far this season. And I think it's a real credit to Willie Kirk and the team and the signings that they've brought in as well. Because, you know, 2 years ago when he came in, they were literally rock bottom of the Women's Super League. And I remember talking on this podcast about the fact that they'd just been beaten by Yeovil Town and what had gone wrong from a team that had, you know, England internationals and players that had left and the kind of state they was in. And Willie Kirk has come in and really changed their fortunes. And I think it's going to be a really exciting season for them. Obviously, we know they're in the 1920 FA Cup final, which is obviously yet to be played. And then obviously all of the cup competitions that are still coming up in the women's season. So I think they're definitely, Everton and Manchester United are definitely going to be really pushing to break into that top three and really add to the competitiveness.
Big US stars settling in as well at the moment in the Women's Super League. How are they doing? Because there's, I'm sure, a lot of money being spent, a lot of attention on those players as well.
Yeah, they're settling in. I think that's a good way to describe it. Particularly, you could see yesterday, Sam Mewis, who is a Manchester City midfielder, she has definitely settled in a little bit quicker. She kind of got her quarantine period out of the way and was fit quite quickly and is already becoming a key part of that Manchester City side, whereas Rose Lavelle, who's probably the most impressive player of the World Cup from last summer, had her quarantine period, then she had a little bit of injury problems. She's got quite a slight build and I think it's going to take her a little bit more time to kind of settle in. We saw her off the bench yesterday, but I think she will be a huge, huge player in the league going forward.
On the future of the women's game, I did want to ask you that we last week on the podcast, we were talking about clubs in League Two, for example, League One, saying that they may have 6 weeks left still to go. We hear about the big names in women's football, the Arsenals, the Chelseas, Manchester United's and Manchester City's. But will the women's side of the game face similar problems in the not too distant future?
I think in some ways, as you say, you hear those big names and those big names do, in most cases, provide a sense of stability that clubs in League One and League Two don't have. That when you have big clubs, they will always have a budget for a women's team, or at least you would like to think so. I think certainly women's football is more difficult down the pyramid. You look at the second tier, which is the Championship. Teams like Crystal Palace are in there. So yes, they have men's backing, but they're already only a part-time team. Currently, teams are relying on £1 million worth of funding from the Premier League, which came in just before the start of the season to help afford testing, which is once a week for the women. And eventually that pot of money will no doubt run out. And that is a difficult situation because obviously the leagues are run by the Football Association, who have had to make loads of job cuts and have lost so much money through the crisis. So I think the longer coronavirus goes on, and clearly it appears it isn't going anywhere, I think there will need to be a discussion in the not too distant future as to where that money will come from, whether they need more help from the Premier League or whether they need to ensure that kind of like the men's clubs are putting more money in. But obviously, as you say, there's a lot of issues for men's clubs themselves.
Our thanks to Molly Hudson from The Times there, giving us the lowdown on the Women's Super League. There are a couple of things we're quickly going to discuss. Just to round off today's podcast, that should be a bumper episode after our chat about the future of English football. But one of the other things that irked fans this weekend, £14.95 from this weekend to watch your team's untelevised matches on the box somewhere. You'll have to, of course, get a login and pay. But that figure of £14.95 angered a lot of people in football, particularly as we've already spoken about the economic pressures in 2020. This almost struck as one of the other moments that football is just so disjointed from the realities of what's going on in the world. I was disappointed to see it. And it was one of those as well that as a journalist, you go, did they think that this was going to be received really well? You know, like who came up with this price point and thought they'll all go for £14.95 a game, even though we haven't paid them back for their season tickets yet. And they're currently still paying their monthly fees for that, even though they can't go to games. Very, very strange, Gregor.
Yeah, and it kind of feels like, again, the Premier League flexing their muscles and saying, okay, we're not going to have fans back in for 6 months, government. The only way that the people that you want to be able to be entertained and sort of have their spirits lifted during this lockdown period over winter is by them paying £15 each for a game to watch their team. So I think there's an aspect to that, and I think there's just an aspect of the greed that we've become so familiar with, and we've discussed it at great length there.
We've already talked about football as a kind of dystopian, scary future. So I think if we're really getting into it, let's pretend that, you know, football is a bit like Netflix. And before, you know, when you're sat there deciding what you're going to watch, you know, click a trailer, like, you know, before you decide whether you're going to pay. All the games have already been played. You know, because to be perfectly honest, when you actually look back at some of the Premier League games that have happened, some of them have been great fun. Obviously, Aston Villa fans would have paid probably £50 maybe to if they known they were going to watch their team beat Liverpool 7-2. But some of them aren't great entertainment, if that's what we're actually talking about now. If we're talking about paying £15, you know, then there's not great enjoyment to be had from it. You know, I watched Lincoln lose against Bristol Rovers at the weekend. I got it with my season ticket because it was a home match, but you know, had it been an away match, I would have had to pay £10 for it to watch it on a not very reliable iFollow stream. And, you know, it's not the same as being in the stadium. So you really are deciding whether, am I going to give up my Saturday afternoon? I really don't. I definitely wouldn't pay £15 for many Premier League games unless there was some weird dystopian future in which I could trailer them and decide, you know, see a few goal math action and know that I was going to be properly entertained.
How about in this wacky world of a ridiculous number of goals that they charge everyone £1 a goal?
And that might be a better way of doing it.
Every paying customer has to pay £1 per goal. So, you know, when you see Aston Villa beat Liverpool 7-2, you think, yeah, I got my money's worth there. If it's 0-0, you go, I don't feel robbed. And there's, you know, yeah. And who knows, maybe in the Premier League will start buying more strikers.
Burnley might struggle. But, yeah, I mean, there aren't many. And I mean, look, like, all jokes aside, all my friends who are Premier League supporters were pretty unimpressed by this, and when there's already great pressure. And the other thing it does is, like with the other debate, is it takes away from what was a very brief and very, briefly exciting idea that we were going to have a big surge around getting fans back into stadiums. That to me is one of the things it takes away from, is that you were initially having this great push to get fans and to get supporters back in stadiums, which benefits the fan and the club. And now we're arguing about paying £15 to watch a Premier League game, which detracts from that completely, which is a great shame as well as being completely disproportionate in terms of the value.
Before I ask you what you'd pay for this weekend's fixtures, let me just say, you should be using that £14.95 to pay to go and see some of the actual football that you can watch, even if that's outside the top seven pyramids of English football. Take your fiver, walk to your local club, whether that be rubbish football in your opinion or not, and give them a fiver, which they need to survive, instead of paying £14.95 to watch some of these fixtures. It's incredible as far as I'm concerned. Not going to get me much work at the Premier League, but there you go. Listen, looking ahead to this weekend's fixtures then, look, there's a Merseyside derby, Manchester City against Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham. I take it those would be £14.95 in your opinions?
No. Merseyside derby's always boring. Maybe a quid. Seriously, it's always rubbish. Like, it's always boring. Like, yeah, £1.50, maybe, if I'm feeling generous. I mean, Gregor loves Mikel Arteta, so he'd obviously pay £15 for City v Arsenal, obviously.
Look, none of them should be more than a tenner. If the EFL are charging a tenner per game in Eiffel, then, you know, the Premier League's supposed to be this global product that, you know, is the most valuable league in the world, and there's... No, I think a tenner's got to be the tops, really.
Hugh, what are you
and
paying?
And even then, that depends upon the refund in the season ticket holders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Hugh, exactly. Man United fan, what are you paying to watch your boys lose 2-0 to Newcastle?
Newcastle against Man United is £6, as far as I'm concerned.
That's got Callum Wilson header written all over it, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You can see it now. Harry Maguire and Victor Lindelof looking at each other going, I thought he was your man, mate. Oh,
exactly.
No.
Listen, if they say Phil Jones is playing, I'll pay £14.95, because that is the Phil Jones fixture, always guaranteed for laughs if he's playing in that. But unfortunately, I guess he won't be this time around. Sheffield United, Fulham, that's what, £4? Sheffield United, Fulham.
I mean, I'm a contrarian, so I'd pay £15 for that just because no one else will. No one else will.
Crystal Palace, Brighton, the non-derby derby.
I think you need to be paid for that, don't you?
Yeah. Again, well, I can find out what form Wilfred Zaha's in beforehand, then again I might part with a couple of quid, maybe.
West Brom Burnley, how much would you pay for that?
Again, I'd pay.
I went too early, didn't I? We definitely need to be paid for that.
The contrarian in me, and also I've got a good friend of mine is a West Brom fan, and that, you know, might be a chance for them to pick up some points this stage in the season, maybe, if they're lucky. So maybe I'd pay to watch that.
The craziest thing is, on the £14.95 price point, when I said to my mates, if 100,000 people watched a game, you know, you've got £1.5 million pretty much. You're like, I mean, that's not exactly electric viewing figures, 100,000 people, but that's a lot of money. Because obviously a portion of it goes to the clubs. Maybe they've worked it out and said, we don't really care if that many people watch it. We get 50,000 people, we'll have £750,000, and that's a decent amount for a game that wasn't even going to be on TV in the UK. But it is another sad day, I think, for football. But look, if none of us pay it, they'll stop. So, boycott. No, seriously, you know, if you're really against it, make sure you don't. Listen, quickly before we go, Gregor, I said at the end of the last podcast that Scotland would probably get knocked out of the Nations League playoffs. And what a performance against Israel.
I mean, there were moments in extra time when I was genuinely losing the will to live. But afterwards, I thought, we might be onto something here. We could maybe like play for nil-nils and we're the best penalty kicks team in international football now. Had one penalty shootout, 1-1. So, yeah, I think in all fairness, there is some positives to be taken from it, in that we, as you say, it's a year since we lost. We're looking quite solid at the back. Steve Clarke seems to kind of finally be, even though there's all these cries about the fact that 3-5-2, what's this mad continental idea, 3-5-2, howls from Scotland, he stuck with it. And yeah, we've got a chance. We're one game away from the first major tournament in, what is it, 22 years. I'll take that.
Yeah, what do you think though? Serbia, is it?
Yeah, I mean, Serbia away as well, it's going to be tough, but who knows? We look solid and we'll win on penalties.
There we go. That's a positive end to a very worrying podcast, isn't it? Greg is so excited about Scotland. I never thought I'd hear it.
Me neither.
Unfortunately, the Premier League are also buying international football and Scotland won't exist by the time we get to that game. I'm only joking, guys, by the way. That was not a piece of factual news, but that is all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. My thanks to Gregor Robertson and Tom Clarke, of course. You can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of the latest news from the world of football. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegameonline. Thanks for listening. Back with you on Thursday. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.